Blog Talk Radio.
Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of a sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
Come on.
All the humanity and all the...
Mary had a little lamb, it sprinkled white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool. Ah!
I never once said, na-da-da.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I have sinned against you.
And welcome back to another edition of Roots on the Radio. The number is 347-308-8701. Thank you for checking us out here on Blog Talk Radio each and every day that you do. And plenty of things happening in the news. Most of them are just news stories. And of course, you know us here. We don't just do news stories. It's news and views. We give you the news and then, of course, give you our views at the risk of sounding like that was some sort of rhyme intentional. But, you know, they just happen to rhyme. And, one of the stories that caught my eye today was, I guess it was a story that I took personal because I have a teenage son. He'll be 20 this year, so that's almost a wrap. And of course, stepchildren, and I have a former younger teenage son. It's 14. He'll be 15 this year. And they're not bad kids. You know, they do your typical sitcom silliness. You know, back in 2009, I remember my son had a party at his mother's house with their new husband. They flew out to California, and he, of course, had a party at his home where alcohol was served. I'll never forget the phone call that I made to him, and I said, "How typically sitcom of you. I mean, you haven't watched enough television shows to know that that never ever works out in your favor?" Happens 1,000 times. And, you know, you think that your children are smarter than that, but they're not. They're kids. Every kid sees a situation like that, and they think they can get away with it. But this is more about the state of our youth today. And I believe that they've become more and more violent. I think this is what their recreation is. Violence is what they respond to. Why? Who knows? Boredom? Maybe it's the YouTube culture. You know, all you have to do is put out a video camera and catch yourself whipping some kid's ass. You know, and the rest is history. You post it, get a lot of views, because, of course, a lot of other kids your age or their age like that stuff. And they view it, a lot of sadistic bastards out there like to see a kid getting his butt kicked, like to see girl fights. They like to see that kind of violence. I mean, why go to the movies anymore? It's not going to cost you $12 to just flip on your computer and check out the latest beating. But it's the state of our kids. It's where they are. It's who they are. Not all, but a large degree. And why is it like that? We'll never know. I always ask myself, why is it like that? I don't know. Diminishment of our culture, no role models, you know, missing dads, single parent households. It could be a host of things. But it's happening. And this particular case caught my eye. As often as we say that parents do nothing about their children going down this path of destruction, one father did. I feel a little bad for the guy because I know there's going to be some scrutiny. And scrutiny is going to come from everywhere to this gentleman for several reasons. One reason is going to be, hey, you didn't raise your kid properly. The other one's going to be, you're a snitch. But let's view the story for those of you who haven't heard it already, but I'm sure you're quite familiar with it at this point.
Imagine you're the parent of a teenager caught on video ganging up on and beating up another child. Would you turn your own child into police? Michael Palomino did, and his son is now facing the consequences.
As painful as the video is to watch, the father of this teen, Raymond Palomino, seen here allegedly stomping, punching, and slamming another boy to the ground, along with six other teens, says it was especially gut-wrenching for him because of the decision he was forced to make after he saw it.
They had to call the 911.
That's right. He called the police on his own 17-year-old son, who was then arrested.
I did what was right as a parent.
All of the attackers in the January 15th beating covered their faces with hoods or masks, except Palomino. When the video was posted on YouTube, close to 500,000 people watched, among them relatives, who then called his dad, a sheriff's deputy of 30 years.
I'm in law enforcement myself. So the right thing was is to turn him in.
And while he still doesn't regret his decision, now he's worried the consequences of his son's actions are too harsh. Of the other teens involved, a 15-year-old girl, two 16-year-old boys, and three 15-year-old boys, Raymond is the only one in jail, and he's also the only one being charged as an adult.
He doesn't have a criminal background. That's the other thing I don't understand.
He's being held on a $100,000 bond, and his dad, a single father, can't afford to bail him out.
They're making him look like he's the aggressor throughout the whole video, and he's not. He's 17. They're trying to make an example out of him.
Even though the victim managed to walk away with a bloody nose and lots of cuts and bruises, police say there is zero tolerance for this.
This is very clearly mob-type behavior. They, you know, get a lot of courage when it's six or seven beating up one person. And, you know, this just isn't tolerable.
Even though his son is now facing possible jail time, Palomino maintains,
I don't regret turning him in. It's just that what he did was wrong, and now he's got to suffer the consequences.
Seven people were arrested in all, but the other six were charged as juvenile delinquents and have since been released. Palomino says when he went to visit his son in jail, Raymond told him he did the right thing.
Now, Raymond Palomino is the kid, of course, behind bars in the event that you missed it. Told his dad during a visit that his dad did the right thing, even though he's sitting in jail with $100,000 bail, and he's definitely facing, you know, he's facing jail time. He'll probably plead out. He'll take a plea deal. There are several things about this case that I find interesting. One, that Michael Palomino, the 17-year-old boy, did not receive leniency, even though his father was 30 years on the force. Let me explain why. If you saw the video, and even though, as the reporter suggests, the boy only walked away with a bloody nose and some bumps and bruises. To watch the horrific nature that these boys beat up, and one girl beat up this young man, they kicked him in the face while he was down, powering. They were sucker punching him in the face from behind him. Which, of course, means that these kids can't throw a punch. And definitely can't kick anybody. But if you look at the nature of this video, you look at the entire video, this young man underwent a brutal beating. A kick to the face. A kick to the face in many situations is a death blow. The power behind one person's foot or leg is worse than a fist. especially as the young man is cowering on the ground, trying to protect himself, but he gets kicked full-fledged right in the face. And he's punched and dragged and thrown to the ground 2-3 times. I think $100,000 bail is appropriate because he participated in such a brutal crime. Now, the other ones are being charged as juvenile delinquents because 17-year-old, this is Chicago for crying out loud, folks. Chicago. And the person they chose to make an example of is the son of a 30-year law enforcement veteran. Now, if it had been any other circumstances, people would have been calling foul. Oh, he didn't get a considerable bail. Oh, it's because his father's a cop. See, no one's calling now. Now everybody's talking about how it's unfair. Well, at least the father is. But the father turned him in. With all of that being said, could you do it? If you had witnessed that video, if you witnessed that beating, and you saw your son, hey, everybody else has got their face covered. These juveniles were smart enough to cover their face with masks and hoodies. But your 17-year-old child, oh, he had to be on camera. You see him at one point even going up to the person with the camera, telling him, get this. Yeah. Film this. While he's beating this poor boy's behind. If you saw a beating like this, and what's the level that you go to protect your child when you found out that he's done something this heinous? Now, I got to be straight with you. Now, I believe in swift justice for violent offenders, and that's regardless of what it is that I went through. I believe in the justice system because I understand that it's flawed, but I believe in the justice system. If, of course, it's out to pursue justice and the right way. But could I do it? If I found out my son was responsible for that beating, and if the boy only got cuts and bruises, found out that he survived with a bloody nose and a bruised ego, would I still call the cop? It's a very, very tough decision for a lot of people. Because it's your child. And if you don't call the police, how do you handle it yourself? I'll admit, for me, there had probably been some violence at home. If I found out that it took my son and 6 other people to beat one kid's ass, that he wasn't in a fair fisticuffs with someone he didn't get along with. If I found out that he was bullying a boy and he needed 6 of his friends to get it done, I would question the character of my son. What are you, a punk? What are you, a wuss? You didn't like this kid? You couldn't take the kid outside and handle your business on your own? Maybe take an ass whipping or maybe deliver one. I'll be honest, that if I saw that and I found out that the kid was all right and I made sure that the kid was all right, me and the boy would have thrown on some boxing gloves. When I'd have told him, your 6 friends aren't here today, let's go. Let's see whether or not you really got this stuff. Oh, yeah, I can see you can handle one poor boy with 6 of your friends, but let's see whether or not you can handle a man. Let's see whether or not you can handle a little fisticuffs with old man. Let's see whether or not you really, really got this stuff. Now, I looked at the father here, Michael Palomino. You know, he's an overweight man. His young son, Michael, is, you know, an average teenage boy. Pops probably didn't want to take it to him. Probably thought that he would lose that round. But I'd be honest with you. I'd have probably punched Buddy in the face. I think I would have caught him. I think he would have had to have felt the wrath of my disdain, of my disappointment. And I don't think that scolding him, reprimanding him, punishing him would have been enough. I think he'd have to take in a couple of hits. I think he would have to take a real sincere blow throwdown between himself and the old scrapper. But he did it. He did the ultimate thing. He called the authorities. The young man didn't call the authorities. Probably told his parents when he got home. He fell down. Fell down a flight of steps, Dad. I'm okay. I didn't tie my shoelaces. He probably did what most kids... Oh, he didn't squeal. He didn't snitch. He took his butt kicking like a man and kept it moving. And if he did that, then fine. I give the kid kudos, you know. He walked away. But he probably, because that abuse happened, he probably would have gone to school again, would have happened again. Kid would have been fur, whatever. It's on YouTube. Kids may have seen it. Spent his entire life being ridiculed about it. But it is a true what would you do story. The number's 347-308-8701. We'll bring in the Intrepid crew, of course. JC, the producer. Mary. Mary, why are you bugging? What are we... Like... You've got a son, and your son's a good guy. He's a good boy. But what do you do, JC?
Wow. Take that, want that. Listen, you want to be Diddy up in a video? Then
yeah.
We finish this video at the police department. I would have called the cops on him.
You'd have called the cops on your son.
Clear, plain, and simple.
Wow. Now, you know what kind
I wouldn't have hesitated. I would have called the cops on him.
Oh. So there's nothing left to do in your eyes. You just got to call the cops.
Absolutely. I mean, I probably would have swung on him. Because that bullying like that pisses me off to no end. And to see that it took six of them to take this kid down, and you're my son, you're the oldest and probably the biggest, but you got a floss for the camera.
Yeah, he's pausing.
What were you going to YouTube it, World Star Hip Hop it?
Yeah, and he pauses for the camera, gets in front of the camera, and makes a couple of, you know, gestures to the cameraman, you know, get this, you know, turn it over here. All right, we're going to do this over here. And it's like he's directing the video, you know, abusing this
Martin
young man.
Martin Scorsese, Diddy,
yeah.
and Tough Guy all in the same shot.
Exactly.
Oh, no, we would have ended that video with my cell phone camera, video camera, and his ass behind bars crying. Daddy, how could you do this to me? And I'd YouTube it, I'd world star it, I'd do every damn thing you could to it.
I know, and a scary part about this, JC, is that I find what that father has created is probably
what's up?
Well, so I was wondering if Mary was there. She's in a car somewhere.
I'm here,
Mary,
I'm here.
Mary, you're there? I can hear all.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, sweetheart.
And
you don't have any kids, Mary, so what say you?
I don't have any kids, but I've been in a similar situation with my mother, actually. That's another show. I would have done what the father did, but prior to calling the cops, I would have beat his ass, and then I would have called the cops.
Yeah, I think that would have been appropriate. I think not that he deserves some sort of retribution for the boy, but I think we all sort of have that sense where, you know, it's because we don't give that kind of punishment to our children that our children don't recognize discipline.
Where was the mother at? What did she say? Did she have anything to say?
Well, it's interesting because Michael Palomino, the dad, is a single father. And he's, you know, I guess, he works in the police force. That's also what I find troubling about this, is that he's a father, he's a 30-year police, a law enforcement veteran, and here it was his son not recognizing what he was doing was unlawful. What he was doing was not just violent, but unlawful. And
you see, I tell you, let me jump in for a second if I could.
Sure.
That's something I've drilled into my kids. When you leave this house, you represent me. And I have a really, really, really good reputation in our community. When you leave this house, you represent me. When you screw up out there, it doesn't fall back on you. It falls back on me. Look how he must have raised them.
Right.
And if you screw up my reputation, I'm going to screw up your social life until you're up and out of my house.
Yeah, but you know what I noticed about that, JC? And I think you made a very valid point. Based on my monologue earlier, I asked the question that why is it that kids behave this way, and I think it's because of what you just said, is that these kids do not want to live under this sort of rule where they don't have their own reputation. They don't have their own identity as kids, that what they do is a representation of who it is or their parentage is. You know, how you behave reflects on me. And when you tell a kid that, the kid is so busy trying to point out, oh, I'm my own person, I'm not my dad, I'm not my mom. They are so caught up in their own self-identification and not understanding their lineage that they need to respect that, that going out on their own and creating their own reputation, they're caught up in doing what? And those are acts like this, where they're creating their own identity, not realizing that you don't have an identity. You're a kid.
Right.
Yeah, but that's a choice. If your parents tell you something like that and now you want to go out and create your own identity, that's your choice, especially at the age of 17, to go out and create an identity of basically being a monster. That was this kid's choice.
But who's he creating?
For his son's well-being and for the well-being of, the greater public, I don't think that the father had any other choice but to do what he did to keep the public safe. Because what if this kid really does have a problem? Say that he has some crazy anger problem or there's something going off in his brain that's causing him to perform such an act.
I understand.
You would have to do it. You have no other choice. It's not only just to teach them a lesson, but it's almost like, I bet you the father was probably like, he was probably scared as ever when he saw that. He's probably like, oh my God, I can't believe that my kid has this much anger or this much hatred or this much disgust for someone else that they could do something like that. Probably scared the hell out of his dad.
It's funny that you say that about his son having that much anger. You know, I watched that video, and I don't see any anger in those kids. I don't see anything about those kids that's about anger. I think that having... I think what kids are responding to is not anger. I think that these kids believe that this violence is fun. This is recreation. That's what I see going on. That this is a form of recreation to them. You know, they think that, you know, I know that
you're breaking up, Chief.
Okay. Kids can watch shows like wrestling, like WWE, and they see that as something fun and entertaining. I think that a lot of what it is that they're doing, they think, and entertaining.
How could you think that something like that is entertaining when you... It's one thing to watch something like that. It's one thing to watch wrestling or to watch violent movies. But when you are actually right there on top of this kid, kicking him and beating the living daylights out of him to the point where he's bleeding, and you're kicking, when you take your foot and kick it into somebody else's face, like you were saying earlier, that's what, I mean, sometimes that has killed people. When you're right there in it, does something not go off in your brain to say, oh my God, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, maybe I've gone too far, let's not do this, let's stop?
Maybe not, and maybe so. I mean, I think in these kids' cases, even though the kid gets up and runs, they get up and chase him afterwards. When a kid runs away, you know, on his own power, the kids got up and chased him. It was like a bloodlust or a thirst for more violence. They wanted to continue even more. They didn't have enough. They weren't finished. I don't know what the end result was. Was the end result to knock him out? Was the end result for him to be unconscious? Was the goal to say, oh, man, remember yesterday we beat that kid, man? We knocked him out. Like, to knock him out unconscious, is that sort of like a
mission? At what point was enough going to be enough?
Yeah, when was it going to be enough, which is a huge question. You know, his father saying that he thought that the punishment or that the response was too harsh by the police department or the prosecutor's office. I tend to disagree.
Well, dating back to what you were saying earlier and what Mary was talking about, I've been in fights as a teen, and I've had a couple as an adult, where I'm in the middle of pounding some guy out, or we're pounding each other out, and I'm thinking, what am I doing?
Right.
I'm thinking, what am I doing? I don't know what's up with this guy. And I know young kids, friends of mine, with a kid who got into a fight with a beat up a grown man. And the guy was a young guy, he was a young teen, and he beat up got into a fight with a grown man who was an epileptic, and he knocked him out. And the grown man ended up dying.
Wow.
And he ended up catching a murder charge on it.
But do they not know that do they not understand that that violence could lead to someone losing their life?
That's just it. It's like I've had a fight after that incident had gone down with my friend's kid. I've had a fight after that, and right in the middle of that fight, I said, wow, what if I hit this guy and this guy's epileptic? And I don't want to suffer that same fate. And I'm not a violent person. It takes a lot to really, really get me going. And one of the things to really, really get me going is for you to screw with my children. If you ever, and that's happening in my old neighborhood, you know, where I lived at in East Hartford. You've been over there. Pretty decent neighborhood, a lot of kids. And the kids get up there and they fight and they carry on. And one of the things that a lot of the parents tend to do is really get involved with what's going on with the kids fighting. They're going to fight one minute and they're going to be friends the next.
Yeah, that's usually the case with younger kids. I don't think teen kids don't do that. I think
they hold grudges longer.
Yes.
But but what I was saying was the reason why I had gotten into that fight was because a parent had stuck their nose into the kid's business outside. And it's like, you know, let the kids be kids. And before long, his wife had slapped my daughter.
Ooh.
Yeah. And cast went ballistic.
Right, right.
And we all went to jail that day. I'm not proud of it, but.
Really?
We all went to jail that day, yeah. This was in 2004.
Wow.
May of 2004.
Oh, wow, really? That was just after you met me?
Well, yeah.
Just after I got to Hartford.
Yeah, right after you got to Hartford. It was May 2004. and we all went to jail, and because you know the kids were out there playing, and the parents got involved. That's how we got into it. But in this situation, it's far different. And I know I didn't raise bullies. You know what I mean? I didn't raise bullies, and clearly this kid was a bully, and his father did right. I agree as far as probably dealing with him physically at home first. And I can't say that I wouldn't do that because I've never come across that situation. But now that I really, 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 really think about it, I think that I probably would swing on him.
Yeah, I think that I would have to handle this at home. Because
first,
I think child to learn how to fight, you raise a child to fight because there are bullies out there. We don't raise our kids to defend themselves against seven people. Why is it that there's a girl present involved in this melee? I will never understand. But again, we've seen this over and over again, and we've seen more and more of our young people, I believe, who are going down this road. And we're not exactly sure or not exactly certain why this is. But they do it. And I don't know. If to judge this on my own, ladies and gentlemen, my best way to judge this would be on a level of whether or not this father did right versus wrong, 10 being right, 1 being wrong. I would put this square around. That would be me.
Well, you would put it, you would judge it to what?
If I put this on right being 10 and wrong being 1, I would put this at about 7.5. And the reason why I say 7.5 is because that final 2.5% in this particular case, the reason why I say that is because what happens after the fact, yes, it's reported that his son said, "Dad, you did the right thing." They're trying to paint this in the media as if the kid knows better now. But I truly believe that that's not the case. I don't believe that boy said that to his father. I think that's bull. Now, between living in a single household, his father being law enforcement, his father ratting him out, I believe that that relationship is going to be very, very strained. And I don't expect a good future or a good relationship between both of them until that young man becomes old enough to know better.
Right.
And if he does, for that matter, grow up to know better. If he matures to the point where he learns that what he did was not only ridiculous but stupid, to pay a consequence. Until that happens. But he may have a hard time in jail. So it still remains to be seen. So I'm going to put it at 7.5 just for that reason alone.
Or he'll likewise get his ass whipped by a gang of people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Until he get and that'll probably happen. He'll probably suffer a worse consequence while he's doing time in jail. And, you know, anything could happen for that matter. Anyway, 3-7 Radio, we'll be back. The number is 347-308-8701. When we come back, New York City could possibly have drones flying above their city. What are we in, Afghanistan? Pakistan? What's going on? Truth on Radio.
An Olympics hit by scandal and deficits. He rescued them. He turned around dozens of companies and became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits. Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn around Washington.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey, guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you,
None of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hey, how you doing?
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're on with Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
Hey, I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer? Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative. Rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun, Santorum is also a favorite of the Tea Party for his efforts fighting corruption and taxpayer abuse in Washington. And Rick Santorum led the fight to overhaul welfare, ending abuse and helping millions go from welfare to work. But that's just the start. Rick Santorum has more foreign policy credentials than any of the candidates. And Rick Santorum's Made in the USA jobs plan will make America an economic superpower again. Rick Santorum, a trusted conservative who not only shares our values, but also gives us the best chance to take back America. Finally, a candidate we can all unite behind. Paid for by Rick Santorum for president.
This is Rick Santorum, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
There's Dr. Oz, there's Dr. Phil, there's Dr. Drew, there's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion, but I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem, you deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on Reese on the Radio, on blogtalkradio.com, 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights on blogtalkradio.com.
Proven conservative leadership. Newt Gingrich. In uncertain times, we need a leader whose commitment to conservative values has been tested. Newt stood with Ronald Reagan. Newt stood up to Bill Clinton. And Newt was there for conservative values. But most importantly, Newt has always believed in the greatness of America, that America's best days are ahead. The choice. Newt Gingrich, the proven conservative leader. Winning our future is responsible for the content of this message.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Reese on the Radio, and you know you can get Reese on the Radio anytime you want by logging on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com. That's right. ReeseOnTheRadio.com gives you all the latest news, all the latest stories that I find interesting, and you can also click on to www.ReeseOnTheRadio.com and listen to archives of my new show, which is on BlogTalkRadio.com. That's right. It's www.reeseontheradio.com. You can get all the latest news, all the latest events, and anything else happening in Reese's world. It's Reese on the Radio, and I'm back right here on blogtalkradio.com.
He defends our freedom, and his record shows it. Ron Paul. Answering our country's call, Ron Paul became a flight surgeon in the Air Force. As a doctor, Ron Paul delivered over 4,000 babies and is a leading defender of life. In Congress, Ron Paul never voted to raise taxes, never voted for an unbalanced budget, never voted to restrict gun rights or raise congressional pay. Protecting our God-given freedom, Ron Paul for president.
I'm Ron Paul, and I approve this message.
Come on, players, stop hating. Stop hating. Stop participating. Stop participating, star. Come on, twinkle, twinkle, baby, twinkle, twinkle.
Reese on the Radio, and we're back. Sitting around waiting for the President's State of the Union. Got a little breakdown.
You're breaking up.
I'm breaking up. Anyway, I can't play music while I'm talking. That's the problem. We're going to be checking out the State of the Union. You hear me better now?
Yeah, you just got to learn to pot it down just a little more.
Yeah, I'm going to drop it down a little more. Anyway, Reese on the Radio. We're back. Number 347-308-8701. State of the Union coming up in roughly about an hour and 20 minutes. We'll talk about that, of course, at the time he's speech. I'll be giving his speech for him. I'll be breaking down his speech right here on Reese on the Radio in our final hour of the broadcast. Some of you will probably be listening to that because you're dying to hear what it is he's going to say. When the President of the United States, George W. Bush, used to give his speeches on the State of the Union, what they used to do is they would release it to the public about an hour before the speech, sometimes even earlier. Speech was already done, you know, whatever. But unfortunately, because of President Obama's track record in the past 3 years, they've been doing a whole bunch of retweets, changing words around, and every president does that. They're always worried about the language or the way that certain things will be perceived, you know, what points we have to make, whether or not we bring those points home. And President Obama is really, really sort of caught in a bind because he cannot give a State of the Union based on his record. And that's what the State of the Union is about. It's to talk about what we've done so far. What have we done so far? What have we accomplished so far? And how it has benefited the Union, the State of the Union. That's what it's for. It's the state of where we are today. Now, there's a lot of criticism because they say Barack Obama will be doing the obvious. He'll be campaigning. I don't believe that 100%. I don't believe there will be any campaigning done by President Obama today. Maybe slightly, but not a lot. I believe what Obama will be doing today is talking about what it is that he wants to do. And that's not what a State of the Union is. It's never about what it is that you want to do. It's about what you've done. What are your accomplishments? That's why it's not a campaign speech. The State of the Union. Here's where we are, folks. This is the plans that I told you last year we were going to get accomplished, and this is how many things we got accomplished. And the truth is, there's not a lot. There's not a lot to go on. And he knows it. The argument will always be whether or not it was his fault, whether or not he's responsible. I believe, and I, in fact, I'll go so far as knowing. Belief is for people who lack knowledge. I know that President Obama will be doing a lot of blaming of the do-nothing Congress. And he will have no choice but to blame others. There will be no responsibility taken by the President of the United States. There will be none. Why? Because that will be used against him during a presidential campaign this year. He cannot in any way take blame. He can only talk about what it is that he wants to do. He will talk about how he is trying to fight for the middle class. But I digress. We'll get into that later. Speaking of the state of our union, post 9/11, which is where we are today, there are several law enforcement agencies across our country that are now using flying drones over the city. Now, if you've not seen these drones, you've probably seen the ones that are used in, you know, Pakistan and used in Afghanistan and some used in Iraq, these big giant flying planes. And they're flying across the land and, you know, they see an enemy target and they can fire a missile, strategically fire on these missiles. I mean, on these positions. But there are these other ones that look like the drones from Star Wars. The Empire Strikes Back, for those of you who remember the movie. Bang on the nap, bang on the nap, bang on the nap, bang on the nap. It's an opening scene. You know, the Empire drops these drones on Hoth. They're flying all around. Anyway, they want to use these in New York City. They want to use these drones in New York City. And they're going to be flying around the city streets looking at people, checking out license plates. They'll be hovering in an area that's only a couple dozen feet above the city. That's 24 feet, ladies and gentlemen. 24 feet. And they'll be able to recognize faces. Yes, there'll be face recognition technology on these drones. And they'll be scouring over the city. Now, as many people would ask here in the story, is it a good thing? Nah. You know Reese on the radio by now. You know the most important question. The most important question is, ladies and gentlemen, where will these drones be? Now, I have my theory, but I know it's a fact. I know that these drones are going to be in certain areas of the city. The question is what portion of the city do you think that these drones are going to patrol? Now think about it. It's a little putt-putt machine flying across the city, 24 feet up in the air, face recognition, taking photos, watching things as they happen live, real time. Somebody sitting around controlling them. Where can you put a drone, folks? Where can you put these little flying hovercrafts for law enforcement purposes? We go to our intrepid crew again. JC, Mary Mary, why you bugging? And of course, our friend Kool-Aid Man, Mr. James of Montgomery. James, we'll go first with you. Drones flying over cities. By the way, there are already a couple of cities in the United States that already have these drones. Question is, where do you think that they're going to put them in New York City?
Brooklyn? not where they say they're going to be. I'll tell you that right now. I mean, it's just so rife with the to be abused, and I'm sorry, it's almost Orwellian. It's 1984.
Oh yes, it is. That's
that.
It is clearly Orwellian. It's 100% Orwellian. But where would they put them? Where would they need to have flying hovercraft drones? Where would they need that?
Well, I know what would be said. It would be said like on the docks or things like that. But it's really going to be in the urban neighborhoods, so they can watch other drug dealers, because you know that is the real problem. And it's going to be in people's windows. I don't know who watches the watchers. That's all I can say.
I'm with you there.
They're going to be in the same neighborhoods that the new app tells you to stay out of.
They'll never make it out of Washington Heights alive.
Now, let me tell you something that I know. I've already got the scenario down. I'm telling you, I see the scenario right now. Now, listen to me. The story on CBS News is going to go like this. Right? A young man was shot in his apartment building yesterday by an errant bullet when a mugger who was spotted by one of the NYPD's drones had caught him mugging an old lady down the street, and he fired his gun to shoot the drone. And that's the news story. That's going to be the story, because you know that some son of a gun who gets spotted by one of those drones is going to see if he could fire a weapon at it.
Well, I mean,
you know, they can barely hit nothing.
I don't get it. What's wrong with the law enforcement in New York City? We can't. First of all, you're going to only put them 24 feet up in the air?
24. They're talking about a couple dozen, just two dozen feet up in the air.
24 feet up in the air. So really, in New York, where are you going to fly them? There's high-rises everywhere. You're just going to fly them right down the middle. right down in the middle of the street?
Fly them anywhere you want. The point is that let me tell you something. They're not going to put drones in the Ground Zero area. You want to know why? Because there are already cops down there. They're not going to put them in the Ground Zero area. Police are already there. They're not going to worry about putting them in Chelsea. They're not going to putting them on the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side.
Anywhere near Manhattan.
What's that?
It's not going to be anywhere near Manhattan.
Well, no, it'll be
it's not
in
be
Manhattan.
In the affluent areas.
No, it's going to
be in Harlem.
Right, it'll be in Harlem. It'll be in Harlem because, as you said, Jamie, which is, I believe, 100% accurate, is that drug dealers, the real problem, as they put it, that's where they – because remember, they're already having a big argument about people people losing their constitutional rights in the stop and frisk program. So now we use the drones to catch them in the act. I mean, think about it. The police will always be there. They don't have to worry about standalone cameras on the light post. Now they have a drone that'll just fly by and patrol the area. They'll catch you in the act all they want. All they have to do is just say.
They'll catch them in the act. And how soon do you think, if that does, by some stretch of the imagination, pass, how soon do they start weaponizing them? If we can watch them. You know, we can watch them. We can't just, you know, we're going to take the picture and wait for the cops. No. Let's put tasers on them. Let's put, you know, it's just, oh, my God, it's so rife with abuse. It's amazing. Somebody was like, hey, that's a good idea.
Of course. Because the police, again, their job is anti-crime, right? The whole idea is anti-crime, to stop crime. But and I'm with you, James, is that I'm wondering where the abuse will begin. It's got to begin somewhere. And patrolling those neighborhoods, some people are going to feel as though they're being monitored 24/7. No one else is bored. Now, I don't know whether or not you heard the story about these drones, but I promise that, in fact, I totally forgot that I had it. But let me get the actual audio from when the story came out. How the information was found out was, I don't want to say funny. To me, I found it to be humorous on who it was who revealed this. If you'll indulge me a little bit, let's just have a little fun right now with who found the story out.
They are used in war zones for surveillance and military strikes, but there are plans to deploy drones in the Big Apple to keep an eye on New Yorkers.
More and more people believe it's inevitable. CBS2's Don Daler explores the drone debate.
Drones are unmanned aircraft that can fly at low altitudes and shoot live video or shoot live missiles. Surveillance cameras already dot the city streets. But is the NYPD exploring the use of even more eyes in the skies in the form of drones? Some evidence points to yes. A website named Gay City News posted this email it says it acquired through the Freedom of Information Act. It's purportedly from a detective in the NYPD Counterterrorism Division asking the FAA about the use of unmanned aerial vehicles as a law enforcement tool. And this part of a recent interview with Commissioner Ray Kelly raised more questions than it answered.
I mean, in an extreme situation, you would have some means to take down a plane.
Drones are already being used by law enforcement in other cities. This is footage of a huge protest in Poland a few months ago, shot by a small drone that could fly a few dozen feet right over the heads of the crowd and the police.
So the story came from a gay website. Gay news website. Now, why they were searching this information baffles me. Why was there a gay...
Because they were searching their free rights.
Right. Well, their constitutional rights, whether or not they're going to be controlled. But again, I don't think that this affects them in any way. I mean, I don't think the gay community.
How?
It's going to be in people's bedrooms.
This affects everybody. Gay, straight, black, white, blue, green. This affects everybody.
Because it's going to be used to be to peep in. It's going to be the peeping Tom syndrome. They're going to be everywhere, and you know, and when they're not, when it's what happens when it's a slow crime day.
Well, again, I agree with you, James. James, you're never going to get agreement, disagreement out of me with this one. You are absolutely right when you say this is rife with abuse. Like, there's going to be abuse somewhere. We're talking about human beings controlling something that can look into your bedroom window.
Yep.
You know, and what will, you know, if let's say the police officer has a hunch that a guy is a serial rapist, or a guy is a pedophile, or a guy is a drug dealer and he deals drugs out of his apartment. If the cop,
or just a suspicious character.
Right, a suspicious character. And the drone decides, hey, can we get footage of this guy inside his apartment, inside his domicile, to see if we can get him actually committing a crime? Not for the sake of issuing a warrant, but for breaking down his door because we caught him in the act. You know,
but it would seem like you would need a warrant to almost do that, to do that, because you are basically looking in their homes.
Yeah, but you know what? Again, but see, you are basically looking in their home, but remember, because you can't really tell what's going on in people's houses, now you can use the technology that may give you a little bit of insight on what's going on in the house. Maybe you're about to raid the person's home and you want to use the drone to fly around to get a little peek on whether or not he's in the house, whether or not he's armed. You know,
well, that's,
even though,
no, because they already have a way to do that. That's what they use, the heat censored helicopter, the infrared
drone
and all that stuff. They have a way to do that.
But again,
yeah, they're called drones.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, this will be, you know, whether or not there'll be abuse, it remains to be seen, but it definitely opens up the avenue.
Okay, what cities, what are the other cities that have already launched this?
I do believe Dade County, Florida is one of the people who are testing the program.
Okay.
That's one
who
of
else?
The people. I know. I don't know who else is. I know there are two other cities. I'm not sure which ones they are. In the report, it said two other cities. Panama, I mean, one of those, they were talking about Poland. But I read a report today where I actually saw a Dade County police officer controlling one of the drones. So there's a program in Dade County in Florida. So, and Dade, and for those of you who are not familiar, Dade County, very familiar, Fort Lauderdale, you know, Miami Beach, you know, that sort of area. So, yeah, so they're already thinking about doing that, but I don't know what the purpose. I couldn't think of Dade County being any other reason other than for drugs. I couldn't think of any other reason.
Drug Central.
I mean, you know, the whole, you know, the cocaine capital of the world, as many people say. You know, I totally see that the abuse is coming just based on that. James, I think you got it right. I think in this case is, you're not going to be spending that kind of money on this kind of program in a low crime, minimal crime area. This is not going to be in Chelsea. It's not going to be in the Upper West. Not going to be in the Upper East Sides. It's not going to be in Murray Hill. You know, it's not going to be in those areas. It's going to be what the police officers consider high crime, high risk areas of crime, high drug use areas. Those are the places where you're going to see these drones, with beyond a shadow of a doubt. And there'll be discrimination claims and everything else under the sun.
And talk about profiling.
Racial profiling.
It's certainly just.
But you know, this steps the police officer away from the controversial stop and frisk program. And, you know, it's funny because that's gotten a lot of heat lately because, you know, again, I believe this is a violation of constitutional rights. When we come back, I want to break down something about the Arizona immigration law and the stop and frisk program. Just
an Olympics hit by scandal and deficits. He rescued them. He turned around dozens of companies and became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits, Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn around Washington.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey, guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hi,
how you
doing?
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're Robert Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
Reese, I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer? Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative. Rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun, Santorum is also a favorite of the Tea Party for his efforts fighting corruption and taxpayer abuse in Washington. And Rick Santorum led the fight to overhaul welfare, ending abuse and helping millions go from welfare to work. That's just the start. Rick Santorum has more foreign policy credentials than any of the candidates. And Rick Santorum's Made in the USA jobs plan will make America an economic superpower again. Rick Santorum, a trusted conservative who not only shares our values, but also gives us the best chance to take back America. Finally, a candidate we can all unite behind. Paid for by Rick Santorum for president.
This is Rick Santorum, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
There's Dr. Oz, there's Dr. Phil, there's Dr. Drew, there's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion, but I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem, you deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on Reese on the Radio on blogtalkradio.com, 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights on blogtalkradio.com.
Proven conservative leadership.
Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourself. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of a sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
Come on.
All the humanity and all the...
Mary had a little lamb in Jesus' mother's soul. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool.
I never once said nada.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I have sinned against you.
It's Reese on the Radio, and we're back. The number is 347-308-8701. And we were talking about this whole drone in New York City possibility, and, of course, the other states or cities, for that matter, who have been trying to implement this drone policy flying over certain cities. And I wanted to bring something up that was an old story. Last year, if not the year before, about the Arizona immigration law that created a crap load of controversy. A lot of people had opinions about the Arizona law, And primarily because people thought it was racially motivated. Because the law had stated in Arizona that if you were pulled over by a police officer and it was found that you did not have the proper paperwork to be in this country when asking you for your license or registration, whatever it is, and you were found to be an illegal alien, that you would be immediately deported. And the argument became in Arizona that this was racial profiling, that some people mischaracterized the law as saying that police officers were told to stop people of brown skin, Latinos. And in reading the 16-page law, to give you a little background, when Attorney General Eric Holder was asked by the by Congress what he thought about the Arizona law and whether or not it usurped federal law, Eric Holder, Attorney General, said that he believed that it did. He was then, the follow-up question behind that was, where in the law do you read that? Eric Holder's next response was, I hadn't read it. But from what he understood, he was interrupted. I apologize, Attorney General, I apologize for interrupting you. But are you giving a reaction to a law that you've never read? Well, I'll be honest with you, I've never had the opportunity to read the law itself. So asking the question, then follows up again and says, Mr. Holder, it's a 16-page law. Some laws are 30, 40 pages long. This is 16 pages. You've not read the law, but you've already given an assumption or given the illusion that you believe that this law is unconstitutional. And the law simply says that you pull somebody over who is already involved in a police action, car accident, pulled over for making a moving violation, in a fight, a domestic situation, violent, whatever it is. When you check their information, if it is found out by law enforcement that you are not a citizen of this country, you are to be immediately deported. Reason being is because Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, believed that the federal government was not upholding the law. And they believed that they had to take the situation into their own hands. Now, I give you that story to then say this. Here in the United States, New York City, to be particular, has a stop and frisk policy where if you are walking down the street in a high crime neighborhood, you can be stopped by a police officer and frisked. And if you are found with drug paraphernalia, a gun, a weapon of some sort, you are then arrested. Now, Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Ray Kelly, who support this law here in New York City, say that they believe that what they're doing is stopping crime. But Mayor Bloomberg, Mayor Mike Bloomberg, excoriated Arizona for what they called a racist law. While they practice stop and frisk program in poor minority neighborhoods in New York City. Now, I bring in the crew again. Anybody understand where that would be a little bit of hypocrisy?
Not a little bit, but a lot.
Mm-hmm. James?
Oh, definitely hypocrisy. Yeah, definitely hypocrisy.
Okay.
Now,
do you believe that the Arizona law is biased? Do you believe that it's unconstitutional?
I believe the stop and frisk law, I believe both of them are biased. Because and think about the wording of it. All right. Who's making the distinction here? What is either suspicious behavior or if you are found in the committing of certain acts. But who's going to follow that? You know, and the way it's worded is so esoteric that you can pretty much say, well, you know, he looks suspicious, so I have to stop him.
That's the New York law. I'm talking about the Arizona law. See, there's no disagreement here that the New York law is absolutely unconstitutional. There's no denying that here. But what about the Arizona law? And if you read the law, that's exactly what it says. If the person involved is already involved in a police action, in other words, you don't pull them over because you suspect they may be illegal. You're pulling them over because they are involved in something that is a police action. You run a red light. You run a stop sign. You get into a fight. You are involved in domestic violence. You commit a moving violation, whatever it might be. And you check their, hey, let me get your license and registration. Hey, give me some ID. Who are you? Blah, 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 blah. And in the midst of that police action, you find out that the individual is not a legal resident. That is the law. Can you tell me how that in any way is unconstitutional?
Okay, let me just scoot in here. So right here in the county that I live in Prince William County, they actually passed that same law.
Yes, they did.
So I don't think that that is unconstitutional. If you're already involved in not stopping at a stop, at a traffic stop, or a criminal, some kind of criminal activity, whether it be in a vehicle, outside of a vehicle, whatever, and you are found not to be a citizen of the United States of America and you get deported, then, hey, that's what it is.
Okay. And now what happened with – because this is the flip side of that has already happened. I believe I was reading a report of a young girl who was already deported. True police, she did give a wrong name. She gave a wrong name, but here's a woman who was an American citizen. She was, she got in a little trouble, gave a wrong name. The name came up as someone that the Interpol was watching.
That's correct. I remember the story well.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
They immediately deported this. I believe she was like 15, 16 years old.
She was about 16 years old. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Immediately deported this child. All right, a child. Okay. And then to find out that there was a mistake made. And, well, even though she wasn't who she said she was.
What else did she say, James? What else did she say? What else did she say? She said that she was from where? Where did she say she was from?
Oh, she said she was from Cuba.
She said Colombia.
Oh, Colombia, Cuba. Okay, well, sorry.
She told the police that she was such and such from Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And like hitting the lottery, she gave a name of a person that was being watched by Interpol that was from Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she was deported. So she falsified her name.
Okay.
She lied.
Falsified her name.
She gave a name, and they did their due diligence and sent her to Colombia.
No, they didn't. Because a fingerprint could have. I mean, if they would have checked and they ran the name, all right, and they should have. You know, the fingerprints don't match the name she gave. The name she gave, her face doesn't match the name she gave. No one did any due diligence. All they heard was a name. They saw a red flag. Get rid of her.
Okay, but tell me how.
We have all this technology now, facial recognition, fingerprinting, where you don't have to get the ink on your fingers anymore. Everything's digitalized. And still no one knew that this wasn't the person this person wasn't who she said she was.
Did they have fingerprints on the chick that she says she was?
She was
arrested. I don't think they had fingerprints on that person.
Well, obviously, if she's in the system, her name popped up as a red flag.
Her name may have popped up, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they had fingerprints on file for her.
That's right.
So then anyone named that. So then anyone named that could have been deported.
Well, remember, James, she's 16 years old, and there's no fingerprints on children. There's no fingerprints on children. They couldn't decipher whether or not her fingertips matched because there was no fingertips to match them to. So there's no fingertips. She had never involved in a police action.
The person whose name came up, the person whose name she gave, the person who was red flagged was in the system. Somewhere along the line, she got fingerprinted. Okay, so if the little girl's fingerprints doesn't match her name that she gave, there's still a disconnect there.
I agree there. I agree with you there. But even with that being said, back to the point, do you believe what Arizona is doing and that law is unconstitutional comparative to what they're doing in New York?
Well, comparative to what they're doing, if you believe the letter of the law, then no. The way it's worded, no. But, again, just like the politician who hasn't even read it, okay, how many
attorney general
do you think are reading that law? All you hear is we're supposed to stop people, frisk them. That's not
what Arizona's law says. Arizona's law says for them that in the event that you stop someone in the middle of a police action and find out that they do not have legal residency, that they are to be automatically put through the system and deported immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So the police officer's job. But the added part of their job now becomes, in the event, usually when you find somebody who doesn't have legal residency, you arrest them, you put them through the regular system, then ICE comes down, and then ICE takes care of them, and they go through that whole paperwork. What they're doing is cutting out the middleman in Arizona. They're saying, we're not going to put them through the ICE system. We're not going to go through that whole thing where taxpayers are going to end up paying for them spending a year in our prison system. We are immediately going to deport them to the country of their origin. And they're saying that they're cutting out the middleman, that they're not going to let the federal government go through this painstaking red tape that most of these illegal aliens go through, who are allowed to stay in the country, that the state taxpayer has to pay for their residency there, as to just get rid of them. They're not in any way advised to go out there and find people that they suspect to be illegals. This is a law that says if you find out that they are illegal in the midst of a police action. See, that's different than let's just pat you down because you're in a building we don't believe that you belong in. You walking down the street coming from a friend's apartment, and because you dress a certain way and because you're a certain age or ethnicity, that the police officer and say, hey, what are you doing in here? Oh, I just came to see my friend. Get up against the wall. That's Gestapo tactics. Those kind of tactics.
Show us your paper. But once again, it's also, as I said, the way it's worded, you wouldn't think so. But put in practice, I mean, what is these actionable offenses? I mean, you could say anything is a police actionable. Okay, he jaywalked, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think in those particular cases, if there are those cases where people feel as though they're being harassed, they have avenues they can go down. What I'm saying is that I think the two are patently different when it comes to the law. What I find amazing is that these same people protesting the Arizona law have not made one argument about what's happening in towns like Harlem, in Bed-Stuy, in Brownsville, in those areas in New York City. What I found even scarier, and I'm not even going to go into this guy because you know my disdain for him, was when the report came out in 2010. In the beginning of 2010, a report came out. The Stop and Frisk program has to put out a report every year. In 2009, it was reported that 570,000 people had been stopped and frisked in New York City. In that report, 85% of those stopped and frisked were Black and Latino. And when that report came out, guys like Reverend Al Sharpton took a plane and flew to Arizona to protest illegal immigrants. See, that's the part that I found. And here is a guy, Al Sharpton, again, and a guy that I don't want to get into the politics of him, but here is the same man who held a political correctness seminar for new recruits at the Apollo Theater months after the Sean Bell shooting took place in Queens. If you're telling me that you're holding this sensitivity training for new recruits in the NYPD, but yet a year later, a year or so later, several years later, in fact, because Sean Bell was many years ago, but you have a situation like that, you're supposed to be treating the sensitivity training, and then you find out 575,000 people stopped and frisked, that 85% of them are Black and Latino in urban neighborhoods. And you're going to tell me that obviously your sensitivity training was nothing. It was nothing more than a picture show. You know, it was nothing more than, you know, a photo op. You know, it's ridiculous that somebody like Sharpton or some of these activists ran out to Arizona to go protect these people who are coming into the country illegally. But those who are legal residents of the United States who are being treated with Gestapo tactics, that no one came to their defense and no press covered it.
Well, because we're not the hot topic anymore. I mean, because that's not it's generally accepted. Okay, you know, people in urban areas, it's not fair, but what are you going to do? But, well, you know, someone who comes into the country from someplace else, then the country looks bad, and we look bad, and we can't have some stranger coming in and thinking that we don't give a darn.
Well, I'll tell you like this. This is what I believe that it was more about. It had to do with numbers. Numbers will always be I always say numbers always are the catapult or the catalyst for this behavior. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. In 2000, Latinos in this country outnumbered African Americans 2-1, according to the census. There are only 38 to 40 million African Americans in this country. There's close to double of that in the Latino community. Only 24% of registered voters people who can vote, only 24% of registered voters show up to the polls during election time. That number doubles in the Latino community. So if you know that you can get 48% of Latinos to the polls, then their issues completely dominate the argument. They dominate the situation. They push the issue. So you protect your constituents who serve you most. And Latinos are higher on the totem pole politically, especially within the Democratic Party, which was why in the African American community, things like the stop and frisk can happen and no one bat an eye. But in the Latino community, it has to be recognized and approached. And I think it's as simple as that. Now, would you agree or disagree? And the numbers don't lie, James. The numbers don't lie.
Well, you know how I feel about that.
Okay.
I've said before, numbers don't lie. The person writing them down does. There is a prevalence here. Because Black people have been putting up for a number of years. We have talked and talked and talked. We're blue in the face, and yet we're given, you know, basic lip service. But truthfully, we're left to fend for ourselves.
Well, because you have no political power, and that's the point I'm trying to make here. You have African Americans have no political power. I'll give you another story, and I talk about this often, about political power. In Brooklyn, in one of the Hasidic neighborhoods in Brooklyn, when Mayor Mike Bloomberg was running for re-election, there was in this Hasidic neighborhood there were bike lanes in this community, and during the summer, a lot of young women would ride their bikes in the summer. It's hot. And a lot of the women riding their bikes through these communities were wearing, you know, less clothing because it's hot. They're wearing probably, you know, a sports, you know, bra, tank top number with shorts or biker shorts. you know, and of course, a lot of women are probably going to look very attractive. They're jogging through the neighborhood, whatever the reason might be. Anyway, this community, this Hasidic community, called the mayor's office and said, we want the bike lanes removed. A week later, the Department of Transportation came into the community and sandblasted the bike lanes. They were gone. Can you imagine anything like that happening in one of these urban communities where blacks and Latinos are? And the reason why is, again, Mayor Mike Bloomberg knew that in a large Jewish community, that getting those votes, you have to adhere to your constituents. But if the African-American community does not become an active part of the political system by going out and voting, being an activist means nothing. If you don't go out there and vote, you cannot expect your elected officials to take you seriously or to take anything that you say with an air of concern.
Amen.
You're not a part of the system. You don't get me elected. You don't get me. Why do I have to do anything for you? Because you're not a part of whether or not I'm going to be elected or not. You know, the same argument was made about Barack Obama when Maxine Waters criticized him for not going into black neighborhoods, that he was going to all of these white communities. When you have a system where you're not involved in it, you know you don't have to be active in getting those people to vote. Barack Obama looks a lot, and I'm not just using him, but I'm saying a lot of these politicians, if they know they've got your vote in the bag, I don't have to do anything for you because you're only going to show up to vote for me or you're not going to vote at all. Barack Obama doesn't have to worry about whether or not black people are going to vote for a guy with an R in front of his name. They know it's never going to happen. You're either going to vote for the D or you're going to vote for nothing. So what do I give you? You offer. You're not. You know, I'm just saying. You're not. You have nothing to offer me, other than your vote. And you're either not going to vote. My argument would be, if I was as arrogant as I could be to African American community, I would have said to Maxine Waters, I'd pulled her aside, and I was saying, say to her, Maxine, who the hell else are you going to vote for? You going to vote?
Okay.
What are you and your black constituents going to do? You're going to vote for a Republican? And she'll look at her right in the face and go, well, of course not. It's like, then I don't have to do anything.
Wait, hold on. Okay, because, again, there's that, you know, that stereotype that blacks only vote for the Democratic, which is patently untrue. Case in point, the host of the show. and then...
No. Hold on, James.
Hmm?
People like Reese... people like Soul Sister Number One over there, and myself, we are the few amongst the very few that vote.
Okay. Now,
I mean, well, yeah, listen,
James,
listen.
You can't say, hold on, JC, you cannot say that it's patently untrue that African-Americans don't vote Democrat far and wide more than they vote Republican. You ask any black person, you know they're not Republican.
Yeah, and you know, you ask them if you go and pull a lever for Democrat all the way across, they'll tell you, yeah, we do it. But that's the thing is, that's only when they get out to vote. Nine times out of ten, it's hard to get them out there to vote, period.
That's right. It's either you're going
to
vote for
there to vote.
Yeah, James.
Okay, because I've been accused of this by you as one of the persons. All right. First and foremost, the right to vote. There's, you know, not only do you have a right to vote, but you have a right not to vote as well. Some of the people, or most of the people I talk to, it's not that they just don't want to vote at all. It's the people that are put in front of us to vote for, especially with a two-party system, okay, if I don't like either one of you, I'm not going to vote.
Well, how do you
There
expect,
is no alternative.
But how are you
There
expect,
is no
Wait. Even if that's the case, James, don't vote based on party line. vote based on your value system. And if you
neither one are representative of my value system, then I'm not going to give you my vote. All right? Which, and actually, to not get a vote should be more telling than the ones you get.
Well, okay, I'm taking your point into consideration, but I want to say this to you, and that's the bottom line. If you don't actively be involved in politics on a level of understanding what it is that's going on, you will never, ever see a change in your system. And I'm going to use a very valid case in point. And if you'll engage me a little bit in an answer and question, back and forth with me.
Okay.
And I'll make this point, and then we'll go to break. I'm going to ask you this, and then let's see how it is that you respond to this.
Well,
can
just
you,
so long as I get to ask a final question myself.
No, you can ask a final question yourself, but let's go through a little question and answer. If I were to ask you to break down the five major black cities in the United States, which would they be?
Five major black cities in the United States?
Yes, five of them.
Well, in the United States, five major black cities. New York, Atlanta, all right, now you put me on the spot here with cities. Now
it's okay.
You gave
three. How about Chicago and Detroit?
Chicago, Detroit, okay. Well,
let's go,
all right.
Let's go with L.A.
Okay.
Let's go with L.A. All right, and there's one more that I'm missing. Philadelphia.
New Orleans.
What's that?
New Orleans.
New Orleans. Okay,
there's
eight. Can anybody come up with two more?
Houston.
Okay, you know what? I'll take Houston. Houston's okay.
Birmingham.
Birmingham is another major city. That's Birmingham is another one. And a final one that I'll even throw in to make it 11, because I was even looking for 10. Here for a major black city, Mississippi, in the state of Mississippi, right?
Okay. Bridgeport.
Right? Now, that being said, if you look at each and every one of those cities I just named, name one of those black cities that has Republican rule.
You're talking red and blue states?
No. I'm saying which one of those major cities are run by a Republican?
Are run by a Republican? Now that I wouldn't know. I couldn't tell you.
You talking about as far as mayorship?
The answer is zero.
All right. The
answer is zero. Now wait a minute. Each and every one of those black communities, especially Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia. Right? All right. LA.
Well, okay, wait. I've answered your question.
I'm not done yet. I'm trying to give you a point.
Well, now you've asked three questions now.
Well, hold on.
It was supposed to be question answer and it's supposed to be like quid pro quo, correct?
No. I understand that it will be. But James, what I'm trying to tell you is that if each and every one of those major black cities are run by Democrats and those are in deplorable situations, Chicago, the city of Chicago, has been run by Democrats for over 50 years. They run in the top five of major decay. Detroit is now a bombed-out city. They're about to mow down 10,000 square feet of homes in the city of Detroit because it is a wasteland. These cities are run by Democrats, and the urban decay is astronomical. So if you're telling me that these people are not voting for Democrats and voting for their demise, please explain to me how it's not. Republicans don't run those cities, James. Republicans don't run those cities.
Okay.
Democrats do. Some of them have been run by Democrats for over 50 years.
I'm not here. I'm not trying to get into a debate on what's better, Democrat or Republican. Okay, that's not. I'm not even going to start down that road.
Okay.
What I was saying,
all right? What I was saying, well, first and foremost, again, here's a question of mine, all right? Now, you have valid points, and I've tried to answer your question as best I could, but, again, you're saying that most people will vote Republican, you vote Republican, and you're not supposed to cross party lines and things of that nature. But how do you explain, if that's the case, or, well, but I'm sorry, I'm getting off my own track, is that it's only black people, you know, or Democrats who vote Democratic and you're not, you know, and the cross.
Blacks that vote Democratic.
Yes, blacks that vote Democrat, yes.
The blacks that vote Democrat, but there are blacks who vote Republican as well.
Sure.
All right.
That is a small minority of blacks.
You're absolutely right.
Small minority. Okay.
Look at look at the vitriol guys like Herman Cain got from the black elite, like Cornel West, Tavis Smiley, what's his name, Michael Eric Dyson, who said that because that Herman Cain was a Democrat, he was smoking the crack pipe. That Michael Eric Dyson said that he was making he was a Republican to curry, he was saying things to curry white paper as a Republican. The vitriol of black men, both Republican, receives such a hatred in the black community today. Please don't tell me that there are plenty of black people who vote Republican. They're not, and they never will be. But go on with the point.
No, there used to be. There used to be.
There used to be. My man, that
was... That used to be the party of the black people, Republican Party.
Correct, but we're talking about Booker T. Washington's days.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We're talking...
Right, and once the Republican standpoints started going to where we weren't represented...
Yeah, well, okay, James, why you said that, let me make a point. So, now, everybody knows that I'm like, on the line here. One foot over one fence, one foot on the other side of the fence. So, okay, I understand what you're saying. Once black people weren't the thing of the Republicans, then black people started voting Democratic. But the Democratic Party is not for the black people either, and that's why all of these cities are still in the situation that they are in.
I mean, that's...
Again, but when you have only the two-party system, okay, and...
Well, that's not going
to
change. You could argue that until you're blue in the face.
You have to take the lesser of the two evils, and it's not just about voting for the president. It's about voting for every seat in the government. Every seat from the smallest
seat
to the biggest.
But when you're only given two people, you're only given two choices. Well, these are the choices you got. But if I don't like either one of them, I'm still supposed to vote. I mean, think about it. The Republicans are even starting to make an end run around that with this loyalty oath.
Oh, James, and that's, again, another...
Charters are available. Charters are available. Applications are out there. Anybody can run for public office.
James, I get
how many people, if you're not either Democratic, or how many Libertarians make it through? You know, now it's either a popularity or a money race.
James, Ron Paul's a Libertarian. His son Rand Paul is a Libertarian. There are plenty of Libertarians. In fact, I don't know if you remember, Joe Lieberman from Connecticut is an independent.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Now, these are the...
James? Did we lose him?
I don't think so.
I think he got caught off. The point that I was trying
to make... No, he's still there. Or he's in the process of getting cut off.
Maybe we lost him.
Yeah, we did. We lost him.
We did? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get him back. Let's take a break for now, because I got so much more to say about this. But I want to get into another story. It's going right on to the topic of what it is that we consider what's racist or racially insensitive apparently there are some kids at the Duke University that believe that they're being discriminated against because of a new survey that says, you know what, I'll tell you when they come back. When you hear the survey, JC, you're going to laugh at this one, because I think JC is actually going to have a very, very strong opinion about this story when we come back. Stick around. It's Reese on the Radio.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Reese on the Radio, and I know you've got an opinion, so give yours. The number is 347-308-8701. 347-308-8701, right here on Reese on the Radio.
Yes, love hurts. It can hurt emotionally, but more important, it can also hurt you physically. It can hurt you in a way which nobody who owns a hot tub and lives in California can afford to be unaware of. Yes, I'm talking about California hot tub rectal gonorrhea. This painful, incurable disease can make an enjoyable soak in a hot tub with family, friends, and dog into a literally unforgettable experience. If you catch California hot tub rectal gonorrhea, not only will you walk around feeling like you're about to pass a twisted sardine can lid, you'll also smell like a pile of burning tractor tires. So don't jump out of the frying pan and into the hot tub, because if you get California hot tub rectal gonorrhea, it'll really burn your ass.
This has been a public service message brought to you by the Citizens Against CHTRG Foundation. California Hot Tub Rectal Gonorrhea. We're not going to take it sitting down.
Hello, Lois. This is Mike. I'm the personnel director here at your husband's work.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
Fine.
Lois, are you sitting down?
Yes.
Well, I have some bad news.
What do you mean, bad news? Bob's okay, isn't he?
Well, actually, that's why I called to talk to you. It's about Bob, and I know that he's been an employee here for a very long time, but I'm afraid we're going to have to let Bob go.
And what do you mean? Wait, that's not very fair. He's been very loyal to you.
Look, I can understand you feeling that way.
Feeling that way? You don't understand. We just had a baby.
No, I understand that.
This is a very hard time to do this kind of a thing.
Yes, it is, but Bob has kind of forced our hand on this.
Why are you firing him?
We caught him doing his secretary on his office desk.
Oh, that son of a bitch!
Look, I know you're upset.
Upset is not the word. That stupid, rotten son of a bitch. I can't believe this.
He's on his way home right now, and he's going to need your support.
I'm going to change the locks on the door. I'm throwing his outside on the front lawn. He can just have it all. I'm not even going to be here when he gets back. And now, I don't feel so bad about his brother.
Lois. It's a joke. Your husband put us up. It's your birthday.
Happy birthday!
This is Stephen Hawking, and when I'm not solving the mysteries of the world, I listen to Reese on the Radio on DogTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to Reese on the Radio on ReeseOnTheRadio.com and BlogTalkRadio.com/ReeseOnTheRadio. This was an interesting story. The number is 347-308-8701. You can check us out anytime you like on ReeseOnTheRadio.com. Send an email to ReeseOnTheRadio@yahoo.com. This was an interesting story, as I said. When I hear stories like this, I always say thank God for the numbers, because the numbers are always important in stories like this. And a lot of you who might remember the Duke lacrosse rape case, that raised a lot of racial tensions in North Carolina, in Durham in particular. And the prosecutor of I believe it's Mike Nifong, who was involved in that, who was a district attorney who ended up losing his license to practice law, and everything it is that he did to sort of, I want to say, acquiesce to the black community in North Carolina and in Durham, did something I thought was not only unforgivable and reprehensible, but I believe was criminal. And as many people know, that the young men involved in the Duke lacrosse rape case, the Duke lacrosse players, were vindicated. Turns out that they didn't commit the crime against this black dancer, stripper, or whatever it was who showed up at their party. And their names were dragged through the mud. Plenty of African-American activists, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, they all came forward. Turned out that the young lady was a liar. In fact, I do believe just recently, or maybe within the last 2 years or last year or so, she has been brought up on murder charges for killing her boyfriend. I don't know what the state of that case is. But now there's a new argument happening in Durham at the Duke University because of a survey, a study, not even a survey, a study that was taken about African Americans' test scores or GPA, grade point average, at the school. And the study that's supposed to be revealed says that the reason why African Americans' grade point averages had been peaking to reach the level of their white counterparts. Well, let me just read it. The most immediate cause for students' anger is a as yet unpublished study at Duke by Duke saying that black students match the GPA of whites over time, in part because they switch majors that require less study time and have less stringent grading standards. Opponents of affirmative action are citing the study in a case they want the U.S. Supreme Court to consider. So in essence, what it is that they're saying is that the black students' grades that everyone's probably lauding, look, the black students, they're keeping up with their white counterparts. And this study was to counter that by saying, well, the only reason why that's happening is because these black students are taking easier courses. Therefore, debunking the survey coming out of Duke University that says that African American students were reaching those standards. And these black students at the school are outraged. Now, I want to give you some numbers. And if you got a pen and paper, or if you can remember them in your head, I want you to think about this. There are 6,500 undergraduates at Duke University. 10% of them are black. 21% of them are Asian. That means that 650 black students attend Duke University on an undergraduate level. The protest at this school, not only about the unreleased study, but about not having cultural centers for the school for African American students, and not enough race-sensitive things happening at Duke University, was protested by black students at the school. The interesting part was that the students that ended up at the president's office of Duke University were only 24 out of 650. 24 people showed up at the protest. The report also says, and I want to make sure that I make this clear, the report said a majority of those 24 were black. So back to our earlier argument with James, here is a clear sense of my point. Here are 24 black students, pardon me, 24 students, two dozen showing up to protest the conditions for African Americans at Duke University. There are 10%, 650 students at that school. And only 24 students showed up, and only a majority of them were African American. Was it 20? Was it 15? What was the number? The report doesn't say that. Why? Probably to get away from any controversy or any embarrassment. That no black student showed up. Because it had been found out that out of 24 students that showed up to protest, that only 15 of them were black out of 650, then it could probably be understood that the president of Duke University said, bugger off. This isn't a legitimate beef. If you think we're disenfranchising the African Americans in this school, where are they? If what Duke University is doing is so racially insensitive, where are they? You came up with 24 people to come to this protest and they're not all black? You mean you couldn't even get 100 black students here? You show up with 24 students and you only have, and only a majority of you are black? How am I supposed to take this seriously? Just because you're black? Now, JC, is this clearly stating my point?
My voice don't matter anyway.
That's exactly what happened. Do you see,
yeah.
This is where the argument is. What are you doing? You're trying to make a point about racial insensitivity, and you couldn't get, you got 650 black students. You only show up with 24, and they're not all black? You had to pull people from other ethnic backgrounds to make your point? Where are the black students? This wasn't
I'm sure of those 24, you had your M&Ms, your pinks.
Yeah, your M&Ms, your pinks, and your bark-chewing, tea-drinking, dreadlocked white boy. This is what I'm talking about. They didn't register for this protest. Only had to show.
And the Asian graffiti artist.
Yeah. All they had to do was show up. This wasn't going down to the polls. This was going out there to make your voice heard. Why is it that the 650 other black students didn't agree with this protest? Maybe the reports of this study were true. Maybe a lot of those black students were saying, well, I did take an easier major. Maybe there's some truth here. And I'm saying...
No. I wouldn't necessarily go that route.
Okay, where are you going?
I wouldn't go that route and say that it's because they took an easier course. Because I have a lot of friends in college that are taking courses that I didn't think that black people knew anything about nor would care about. I think it's a shiftlessness and laziness.
Well, you're saying for not showing up to the protest or for their grade?
For not showing up to the protest. It's shiftless and laziness.
Well, what if they didn't agree with the protest? What if African-American students there didn't agree with the protest? That they should have a cultural center? Maybe some of those, because I know there are some kids in there just going, I mean, a cultural center? I mean, I'm not going to
be here in 3 years anyways. What do I care?
What do I need a cultural center here for? I don't need all that. It's like, that just sounds like a BS statement. I'm not going for that. So what? I mean, they're talking about making a cultural center for African-Americans. And what I think that the whole... precipice of all this is, I think the motivation here is to create some tension and to get some news press, because they clearly got it, because I think the news is thirsty for that kind of racist rhetoric. Oh, black people don't think that, they think they're disenfranchised at an all-white school? Oh yeah, we're covering that. But, and then you do the report, you show up at this protest and there are 24 people there. And you don't even report how many black students are there? This is supposed to be a black issue.
You took up the cause, Mr. and Mrs. Reporter.
Yeah, the cause You come down there. You waste camera time. You waste fuel. You drive all the way down there. You know there's a hotbed of racial controversy down there because of the Duke Lacrosse rape case. And you figure you got a story, and you get there, and it's a bubkiss.
Well, got your hair done. Practice your neck rocking on the way to
And you got nothing. This is an embarrassment.
It's a dud.
It's an embarrassment. And I'm the president of Duke University, and I'm going, I'm not showing up to do anything for 24 students. I got 6,500 kids that go to school here and good money to be here and don't need this. I am not going to break my back for 24 students to get you a cultural center that in essence you're telling me that maybe 20 of you will show up to. I'm going to build a big building that I'm going to get. I'm going to hire a staff, security, logistics, building costs, maintenance for 24 kids. This makes no sense to me.
If you want one, contact your celebrities. Have them donate.
There you go.
We'll build you one.
That's right. We'll build you one. Have them build you one. Is Mary on the line? Where's Mary at? Mary.
Where's Will? Where's Jada?
Yeah, where's Will and Jada? Mary, why are you bugging? Are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah. Sweetheart.
Well, yeah, because you had me on mute. I was trying to talk. Thank you.
I apologize.
I don't understand what a cultural center is even going to do for anybody anyway, regardless of whether there's 24 people or 2,400 people that show up. What is the cultural center going
to
do?
It's supposed to teach you about black people, black life, being black, why you're black, who's black.
And why not?
Okay.
But why not?
What does that have to do with taking harder courses or easier courses? These white kids must be taking easier courses too, and that's why their grades are good. How about the white kids try to take harder courses and see how their grades do in the harder courses? Harder courses are designed to make you work harder. Easier courses are designed to let you just get through and get you a college degree. So
you
want to
know what would have been more interesting?
Black or white, it doesn't matter. If it's an easy course, it's an easy course. I mean, so I don't even understand the whole point of the study, first of all, it's just stupid. And it is appalling that out of 650 black students, only 24 show up. Where
maybe.
Are the other 621 at?
Maybe 24.
They can't be studying because they're not taking hard courses.
Yeah, well,
hey, Mary?
What?
I think a more interesting study would have been of the white students there. How much are their grades?
Yeah, they should take a study of the white students too.
No. How much do they measure up to the Asian students?
Oh yeah,
I'd
have done that study. I don't know whether or not that study was conducted. I can't say that
you
it was.
You can't do one without doing the other.
Oh yeah, I'm certain that they probably did. I mean,
They probably didn't even bother because they knew that the Asian kids, the 21% of Asian kids, would have blew them out of the water anyway.
You could have gotten two studies out of that one, because if whites measured up to Asians here in this country, it goes to show you that once you come here from another country, especially if you're Asian, and our white students aren't measuring up to Asian students across seas, then you come to America, you get dumb.
Well, yeah, exactly. You can make a strong point for that. I'm not saying that the test wasn't done. I'm sure that study was probably done as well. But because of this, the racial connotation in this story, I think the press made it a part of their lead because they know that there are African-American tensions between their white counterparts in that area of Durham, primarily because of the Duke Lacrosse case. But my whole thing was, just when I read it, was how are you going to have only 24 students show up When I read 24 students show up, I was appalled. And then the next line is, a majority of those students were black. And I'm going, what?
A majority could have been.
No, no, no. You weren't appalled.
No, I wasn't.
And a majority. No, he wasn't appalled. You're right, JC.
I really wasn't.
Whoa. What are you?
It just sounded good.
What are you insinuating? What are you insinuating?
It sounded good.
Your expectations
you
were bad.
You weren't appalled. You weren't surprised.
I think that you guys are trying to call me racist.
Racist? No, you can't. You know, you can't be racist because you'll never, ever, ever be able to change the color of that skin.
So you're saying that I was happy to hear that 24 students showed up and only a majority of them were black? You think that?
No,
I'm
not. I'm not saying that you were happy.
You know what? Yeah. You know why?
Okay.
Because it's ironic that this story followed our last story, and it bolsters your claim. It proves your point.
Look at you,
JC, reading him like a book.
I wasn't planning on talking about the Arizona law and politics with African Americans and whether or not they vote. I had no plan on that. I was just going to talk about the story. But you're right. Yes, it does only prove my claim. But again, I get proven all the time right on this claim. I'm proven often on this.
And you know me, I hate it when you're right.
I know you do.
I hate it with a passion when he's right. It drove me. That's how we met.
Yeah.
Me trying to find ways to antagonize him into being wrong.
Don't
prove
worry
him
about
wrong.
That, JC, I am on my job. Don't you worry about that because I've been doing some research.
Mary.
And that Dane Gingrich, I will get Reese on him at some point.
Hey, look, I'm only taking Gingrich because he's supposed to be the President of the United States. That's the only reason why I'm taking Gingrich.
Because he's supposed to be the President of the United States?
That's just me. All right, let's take a break. Let's do the top of the hour. We'll be back.
Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of a sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
Come on.
All the humanity. All the...
Harry has a little man. He sleeps by the snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the man was sure to go.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool. Ah!
I never once said, na-da-da.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I help send against you.
All right, and we're back. It's Reese on the radio. Number is 347-308-8701. Our fearless leader, President Barack Obama, is about to take the podium at the State of the Union address. His third, talking about what I believe is going to be a focus on the middle class. And before he gets out there, let's just go through some of these talking points that he'll be going after. He said he'll lay down a blueprint for the economy that's built to last, an economy built on American manufacturing, American energy, skills for American workers, and renewal of American values. The president believes this is going to be a make-or-break moment for the middle class and those trying to reach it. What's at stake is the very survival of the basic American promise that if you work hard, you can do well enough to raise a family, own a home, and put a little away for retirement.
I had a question.
What do you got?
I keep hearing, I mean, in every election from the time I was able to understand elections and how they operate, I keep hearing middle class, middle class, middle class, middle class, middle class. Who in the hell is representing the lower class?
No one is. Again, that's never ever the plight of anyone for that matter. You have to understand. When people, only Democrats talk about the middle class. They only talk about the middle class. That's their target audience, the middle class. Because the middle class are people who don't want to be rich, as I just expressed to you. The president believes this is a make-or-break moment for the middle class and those trying to reach it. What's at stake is the very survival of the basic American promise that if you work hard, you can do well enough to raise a family, own a home, and put a little away for retirement. He's not talking about becoming wealthy. He's not talking about becoming rich beyond your wildest dreams. He's not talking about entrepreneurship. He's not talking about being a financial success. He's talking about reaching a certain standard. It's a very, very Eurocratic way of life. That you make enough. There's a tipping point. And the rest of the world, rich and the poor, all he believes is that taking from the rich and giving to the poor and making sure that the middle class can maintain middle classhood. That's what it is that he's doing. It's divisive. Talk about raising taxes on the wealthy to a point where he wants to raise the investment rate, the corporate tax rate the investment tax rate to 20%, which is going to make every person who invests their money run for the hills. Because 15% is too low. As I said eloquently on this show, as I always do, make $250,000 a year, President Obama believes that you owe 39.6% of your wages to the federal government. Now, if somebody makes $250,000 and they're a married couple, you take that income, they probably own a home. Probably have 2.5 kids. They will put their kids through college. They probably want a summer home. They probably want to buy a new car. They probably have to buy their kids a car. They probably want to save. They want to be able to retire. Depending on Social Security, they don't want it. They've made enough. The reason why they're saving their money for retirement is because they don't want to depend on Social Security, because they know that money is too little or it won't be there at all. And the president is doing a classic class warfare. If you're poor in this country and you're not making ends meet, he will demonize those who are wealthy. Use lines like fair share and over and over and over. Fair share. What is one's fair share? They believe people who are millionaires and billionaires should give 50% of their pay. What am I doing all the work for? They don't believe that you're doing any work at all. If you're making $1 million a year, you didn't earn it. And you have to give half of that back. Oh, you're supposed to make $500,000. That's feasible in the world of Barack Obama. That's acceptable in the world of Barack Obama. If you're rich in this country, you are an enemy of this country. It's a sad state of the world, but that's where we are today. It's exactly where it is that we are today. It says here that the economic security of the middle class has eroded over decades. Long before the recession, good jobs and manufacturing began leaving our shores. Hard work stopped paying off for far too many Americans. Those at the top saw their incomes rise like never before. But the vast majority of Americans struggling with costs that were growing and paychecks that weren't. In 2008, the house of cards collapsed. Mortgages were sold to people who couldn't afford them. A policy forged by Democrats. That's right. And the banks made huge bets and bonuses made with other people's money. You mean money they didn't have? I'm just going to zip it. I'm going to zip it. I'm just going to watch the rest of the State of the Union. Are you guys with me?
I'm here.
I think we should just watch the State of the Union. Mary, how about you? You with that?
I'm with it.
Okay, is there any way we can get audio on the show? I think I can. Hold on, I can do it.
You should be able to.
Hold on, I can get it. I'm going to turn up the volume on my end. Let's see if we can get this live.
We gather tonight knowing that this generation of heroes have made the United States safer and more respected around the world.
Is this where all Democrats are going to be standing up and clapping while Republicans seat?
Yeah.
For the first time in 9 years, there are no Americans fighting in a war.
Race is not that good.
What's that, guys?
It's not that good. I mean, I can hear him say a couple of things, but I can't hear everything.
All right.
Well, they all seem to be standing and sitting at the same time. I usually like watching like synchronized swimming.
They're not consumed with personal ambition. They don't obsess over their differences. They focus on the mission at hand.
Oh God, is he really going to do this?
You can't get it on audio live in live stream.
I think I can. I'm going to see if I can get the live stream now.
If I can watch Bill O'Reilly live stream, you got to be able to get this live stream.
Yeah, I'm going to do it right now. Let me see if I can do this now. I think it's important that we at least...
A generation of high-tech manufacturing and high-paying jobs. A future where
we
can control of our own energy.
Yeah, we're going to chip. Join in progress, as they say. The State of the Union.
An economy built to last.
So that we can get the entire thing.
We can do this. I know we can because we've done it before. At the end of World War II, when another generation of heroes returned home from combat, they built the strongest economy and middle class the world has ever known. My grandfather, a veteran of Patton's Army, got the chance to go to college on the GI Bill. My grandmother, who worked on a bomber assembly line, was part of a workforce that turned out to back bottom. The two of them shared the optimism of a nation that had triumphed over a depression and fascism. They understood they were part of something larger. They were contributing to a story of success that every American had a chance to share. The basic American promise that if you worked hard, you can do well enough to send your kids.
It's breaking up, Reese.
The defining issue of our time is how to keep that promise alive. No challenge is more urgent. No debate. We have to for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by. Or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot, and everyone does their fair share, and everyone plays by the same set of rules. Them. Let's remember how we got here. Long before the recession, jobs and manufacturing began leaving our shores. Technology made businesses more efficient, but also made some jobs obsolete. Folks at the top saw their incomes rise like never before. But most hardworking Americans struggled with costs that were growing, paychecks that weren't, and personal debt that kept piling up. In 2008, the house of cards collapsed. We learned that mortgages had been sold to people who couldn't afford or understand them. Banks had made huge bets and bonuses with other people's money. Regulators had looked the other way or didn't have the authority to stop the bad behavior. It was wrong. It was irresponsible, and it plunged our economy into a crisis that put millions out of work, saddled us with more debt, and left innocent, hardworking Americans holding the bag. In the 6 months before I took office, we lost nearly 4 million jobs, and we lost another 4 million before our policies were in full effect. Those are the facts, but so are these. In the last 22 months, businesses have created more than 3 million jobs. Last year, they created the most jobs since 2005. American manufacturers are hiring again, creating jobs for the first time since the late 1990s. Together, we've agreed to cut the deficit by more than $2 trillion. And we've put in place new rules to hold Wall Street accountable so a crisis like this never happens again. The state of our union is getting stronger. Too far to turn back now. As long as I'm president, I will work with anyone in this chamber to build on this momentum. But I intend to fight obstruction with action, and I will oppose any effort to return to the very same policies that brought on this economic crisis in the first place.
Yay.
Bull crap.
No, we will not go back to an economy weakened by outsourcing, bad debt, and phony financial problems. Tonight, I want to speak about how we move forward and lay out a blueprint for an economy that's built to last. A an economy built on American manufacturing, American energy, skills for American workers, and a renewal of American values. This blueprint begins with American manufacturing. On the day I took office, our auto industry was on the verge. Some even said we should let it die. With a million jobs at stake, I refused to let that happen. In exchange for help, we demanded responsibility. We got workers and automakers to settle their differences. We got the industry to retool and restructure. Today, General Motors is back on top as the world's number one automaker.
That's a lie!
If not, then who is?
The General Motors? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. They toppled Chrysler.
Faster in the U.S. than any major car company. Ford is investing billions in U.S. plants and factories. And together, the entire industry added nearly 160,000 jobs. We bet on American workers. We bet on American ingenuity. And tonight, the American auto industry is back.
When is he going to start talking about the state of the future?
He's already done. He's talking about the future now.
It can happen in Cleveland and Raleigh. We can't bring every job back that's left our shore. Right now, it's more expensive to do business in places like China. Meanwhile, America is more productive. A few weeks ago, the CEO of Masterline told me that it now makes business sense for him to bring jobs back home.
Yes, Obama, yes.
For the first time in 15 years, Masterline's unionized plant in Milwaukee is running at full capacity.
Because more people are locking up their stuff. Masterline?
Huge opportunity at this moment. Manufacturing back. We have to seize it. My message to business leaders is simple. Ask yourselves what you can do to bring jobs back to your country. And your country will do everything we can to help you succeed. With our tax code. Right now, companies get tax breaks for moving jobs and profits overseas. Meanwhile, companies that choose to stay in America get hit with one of the highest tax rates in the world.
Yeah, no kidding.
It makes no sense. And everyone knows it. But let's change it. First, if you're a business that wants to outsource jobs, you shouldn't get a tax deduction for doing it. That money should be used to cover moving expenses for companies like Masterlock that decide to bring jobs home. Second, no American company should be able to avoid paying its fair share of taxes by moving jobs and profits overseas. Now, not every multinational company should have to pay a basic minimum tax, and every penny should go towards lowering taxes for companies that choose to stay here and hire here in America.
How the hell do you do that?
Third, if you're an American manufacturer, you should get a bigger tax cut. If you're a high-tech manufacturer, we should double the tax deduction you get for making your products here. And if you want to relocate in a community that was hit hard when a factory left town, you should get help financing a new plant, equipment, or training for new workers. So my message is simple.
It is time to stop rewarding businesses that ship jobs overseas and start rewarding companies that create jobs right here in America. Send me these tax reforms, and I will sign them right away. We're also making it easier for American businesses to sell products all over the world. 2 years ago, I set a goal of doubling U.S. exports over 5 years. With the bipartisan trade agreements we signed into law, we're on track to meet that goal ahead of schedule. And soon there will be millions of new customers for American goods in Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Soon there will be new cars on the streets of Seoul imported from Detroit and Toledo and Chicago. I will go anywhere in the world to open new markets for American products. And I will not stand by when our competitors don't play by the rules. We've brought trade cases against China at nearly twice the rate as the last administration. And it's made a difference. Over 1,000 Americans are working today because we stopped the surge in Chinese tires. But we need to do more.
No kidding.
It's not right when another country lets our movies, music, and software be pirated. It's not fair when foreign manufacturers have a leg up on ours only because they're heavily subsidized. Tonight, I'm announcing the creation of a trade enforcement unit that will be charged with investigating unfair trading practices in countries like China. There will be more inspections. There will be more inspections to prevent counterfeit or unsafe goods from crossing our borders. And this Congress should make sure that no foreign company has an advantage over American manufacturing when it comes to accessing financing or new markets like Russia. Our workers are the most productive on earth, and if the playing field is level, I promise you, America will always win. I also hear from many business leaders who want to hire in the United States, but can't find workers with the right skills. Growing industries in science and technology have twice as many openings as we have workers who can do the job. Think about that. Openings at a time when millions of Americans are looking for work. It's inexcusable, and we know how to fix it. Jackie Bray is a single mom from North Carolina who was laid off from her job as a mechanic. Then Siemens opened a gas turbine factory in Charlotte and formed a partnership with Central Piedmont Community College. The company helped the college design courses and laser and robotics training. It paid Jackie's tuition, then hired her to help operate their plant. I want every American looking for work to have the same opportunity as Jackie did. Join me in a national commitment to train 2 million Americans with skills that will lead directly to a job. My administration has already lined up more companies that want to help. Model partnerships between businesses like Siemens and community colleges in places like Charlotte, Orlando, and Louisville are up and running. Now you need to give more community colleges the resources they need to become community career centers, places that teach people skills that businesses are looking for right now, from data management to high-tech manufacturing. And I want to cut through the maze of confusing training programs so that from now on, people like Jackie have one program, one website, and one place to go for all the information and help that they need. It is time to turn our unemployment system into a re-employment system that puts people to work. reforms will help people get jobs that are open today. But to prepare for the jobs of tomorrow, our commitment to skills and education has to start earlier. For less than 1% of what our nation spends on education each year, we've convinced nearly every state in the country to raise their standards for teaching and learning. The first time that's happened in a generation. But challenges remain, and we know how to solve them. At a time when other countries are doubling down on education, tight budgets have forced states to lay off thousands of teachers. We know a good teacher can increase the lifetime income of a classroom by over $250,000. A great teacher can offer an escape from poverty to the child who dreams beyond his circumstance. Every person in this chamber can point to a teacher who changed the trajectory of their lives. Most teachers work tirelessly with modest pay, sometimes digging into their own pocket for school supplies, just to make a difference. Teachers matter. So instead of bashing them or defending the status quo, let's offer schools a deal. Give them the resources to keep good teachers on the job and reward the best ones. And in return, grant schools flexibility to teach with creativity and passion, to stop teaching to the test, and to replace teachers who just aren't helping kids learn. That's a bargain worth making. We also know that when students don't walk away from their education, more of them walk the stage to get their diploma. When students are not allowed to drop out, they do better. So tonight, I am proposing that every state, requires that all students stay in high school until they graduate or turn 18. The most daunting challenge can be the cost of college. At a time when Americans owe more in tuition debt than credit card debt, this Congress needs to stop the interest rates on student loans from doubling in July. Extend the tuition tax credit we started that saves millions of middle-class families thousands of dollars, and give more young people the chance to earn their way through college by doubling the number of work-study jobs in the next 5 years. Of course, it's not enough for us to increase student aid. We can't just keep subsidizing skyrocketing tuition. We'll run out of money. States also need to do their part by making higher education a higher priority in their budgets. And colleges and universities have to do their part by working to keep costs down. Now, recently I spoke with a group of college presidents who've done just that. Some schools redesign courses to help students finish more quickly. Some use better technology. The point is, it's possible. So let me put colleges and universities on notice. If you can't stop tuition, the funding you get from taxpayers will go down. Higher education can't be a luxury. It is an economic imperative that every family in America should be able to afford. Now let's also remember that hundreds of thousands of talented, hardworking students in this country face another challenge: the fact that they aren't yet American citizens.
Uh-oh.
Many were brought here as small children, are American through and through, and they live every day with the threat of deportation. Others came more recently to study business and science and engineering. But as soon as they get their degree, we send them home.
to invent new products and create new jobs somewhere else. That doesn't make sense.
Yes, it does.
I believe as strongly as ever that we should take on illegal immigration. That's why my administration has put more boots on the border than ever before. That's why there are fewer illegal crossings than when I took office. The opponents of action are out of excuses. We should be working on comprehensive immigration right now. But if election year politics keeps Congress from acting on a comprehensive plan, let's at least agree to stop expelling responsible young people who want to staff our lands, start new businesses, defend this country. Send me a law that gives them the chance to earn their citizenship. I will sign it right away. You see, an economy built to last is one where we encourage the talent and ingenuity of every person in this country. That means women should earn equal pay for equal work.
Yes, Obama, yes.
When is he going to talk about African Americans?
He's saying he's done talking
know.
To us.
After all, innovation is always been about.
So in love with you.
So let's pass an agenda that helps them succeed. Tear down regulations that prevent aspiring entrepreneurs from getting the financing to grow. Expand tax relief to small businesses that are raising wages and creating good jobs. Both parties agree on these ideas. So put them in a bill and get it on my desk this year. Innovation also demands basic research. Today, the discoveries taking place in our federally financed labs and universities but leave new treatments that kill cancer cells but leave healthy ones untouched. New lightweight vests for cops and soldiers that can stop any bullet. Don't gut these investments in our budget. Don't let other countries win the race for the future. Support the same kind of research and innovation that led to the internet, to new American jobs and new American industries. And nowhere is the promise of innovation greater than in American-made energy.
Uh-oh.
Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources.
After a six-month moratorium.
Right now.
Yeah, after gas prices went up $2 since 2008 when he took office.
Yeah, exactly.
For 8 years. Not only that, last year we relied less on foreign oil than in any of the past 16 years.
Then why are we paying so much for it?
Exactly.
With only 2% of the world's oil reserves, oil isn't enough.
Uh-oh.
This country needs an all-out, all-of-the-above strategy that develops...
Huffy, Slim.
Oh, wait. I'm actually surprised. A lot of Republicans are standing for that. Every available source.
Cleaner. Cheaper. And full of new jobs.
Like Solyndra.
We have a supply of natural gas that can last America nearly 100 years.
And my administration will take every possible action to safely develop the thing. Experts believe this will support more than 600,000 jobs by the end of the decade. And I'm requiring all companies that drill for gas on public lands to disclose the chemicals they use. But America will develop this resource without putting the health and safety of our citizens at risk.
It's already caused an earthquake.
Gas will create jobs and power trucks and factories that are cleaner and cheaper, proving that we don't have to choose between our environment and our economy. And by the way, it was public research dollars over the course of 30 years that helped develop the technology to extract all this natural gas out of shale rock, reminding us that government support is critical in helping businesses get new energy ideas off the ground. Now, what's true for natural gas is just as true for clean energy.
Uh-huh.
In 3 years, our partnership with the private sector has already been a leading manufacturer at that. Because of federal investments, renewable energy use has nearly doubled. And thousands of Americans have jobs because of it. When Brian Ritterby was laid off from his job making furniture, he said he worried that at 55, no one would give him a second chance. But he found work at Energetics, a wind turbine manufacturer in Michigan. Before the recession, the factory only made luxury yachts. Today, it's hiring workers like Brian who said, I'm proud to be working in the industry of the future. Our experience with shale gas, our experience with natural gas, shows us that the payoffs on these public investments don't always come right away. Some technologies don't pan out.
Like Solyndra? Like Solyndra?
But I will not walk away from the promise of clean energy. I will not walk away from workers like Brian.
I will keep spending your money on Solyndras and companies like...
feed the wind or solar or battery industry to China or Germany because we refuse to make the same commitment here. We've subsidized oil companies for a century. That's long enough. It's time to end the taxpayer giveaways to an industry that rarely has been more profitable and double down on a clean energy industry that never has been more promising.
It isn't profitable.
We can also spur energy innovation with new incentives. The differences in this chamber may be too deep right now to pass a comprehensive plan to fight climate change. But there's no reason why Congress shouldn't at least set a clean energy standard that creates a market for innovation. So far, you haven't acted. Well, tonight, I will. I'm directing my... to allow the development of clean energy on enough public land to power 3 million homes. And I'm proud to announce that the Department of Defense, working with us, the world's largest consumer of energy, will make one of the largest commitments to clean energy in history, with the Navy purchasing enough capacity to power 250,000 homes a year. Of course, the easiest way to save money is to waste less energy. So here's a proposal. Help manufacturers eliminate energy waste in their factories and give businesses incentives to upgrade their buildings. Their energy bills will be $100 billion lower over the next decade. And America will have less pollution, more manufacturing, more jobs for construction workers who need it. Send me a bill that creates these jobs.
Send me one tonight and I'll sign it.
Building this new energy future should be just one part
of a broader agenda to repair America's infrastructure. So much of America needs to be rebuilt. We've got crumbling roads and bridges.
Economy.
A power grid that wastes too much energy.
Your presidency.
An incomplete small business owner in rural America from selling her products all over the world. During the Great Depression, America built the Hoover Dam and the Golden Gate Bridge. After World War II, we connected our states with a system of highways. Democratic and Republican administrations invested in great projects that benefited everybody.
That made sense.
Workers who built them to the businesses that still use them today.
But he ain't doing nothing about that.
Order, clearing away the red tape that slows down too many construction projects. But you need to fund these projects. Take the money we're no longer spending at war, use half of it to pay down our debt, and use the rest to do some nation building right here at home.
That's the line. That's the line that everybody's going to be talking about tomorrow. That was the one. That's the one that he said it right there. Nation building at home.
There's never been a better time to build. Especially since the construction industry was one of the hardest hit when the housing bubble burst. Of course, construction workers weren't the only ones who were hurt. So were millions of innocent Americans who've seen their home values decline. And while government can't fix the problem on its own, responsible homeowners shouldn't have to sit and wait for the housing market to hit bottom to get some relief. And that's why I'm sending this Congress a plan that gives every responsible homeowner the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgage by refinancing at historically low rates. No more red tape, no more runaround from the banks. A small fee on the largest financial institutions will ensure that it won't add to the deficit and will give those banks that were rescued by taxpayers a chance to repay a deficit of trust.
Didn't he do this already?
Yeah, of course he did. And he's talking about these banks that got the loans. They paid them all back. All the loans are paid back. He's making it sound like they still have the money.
Let's never forget, millions of Americans who work hard and play by the rules every day deserve a government and a financial system that do the same. It's time to apply the same rules from top to bottom. No bailouts, no handouts, and no cop-outs. An America built...
Well, where the hell have you been for the last 3.5 years?
We've all paid the price for lenders who sold mortgages to people who couldn't afford them.
There you go.
Buyers who knew they couldn't afford them. That's why we need smart regulations to prevent responsible behavior.
And it took you 3.5 years to figure that out.
Well, three.
Rules to prevent financial fraud or toxic dumping or faulty medical devices. These don't destroy the free market. They make the free market work better. Now, there's no question that some regulations are outdated, unnecessary, or too costly.
When are we going to talk about health care?
Fewer regulations.
He's not going to talk about that.
Than my Republican
Come on.
Did in his.
Again, after Bush again.
I've ordered every federal agency to eliminate rules that don't make sense. We've already announced over 500 reforms, and just a fraction of them will save business and citizens more than $10 billion over the next 5 years.
That's it?
We got rid of one rule from 40 years ago that could have forced some dairy farmers to spend $10,000 a year proving that they could contain a spill because milk was somehow classified as an oil. And with a rule like that, I guess it was worth crying over spill.
Quite the comedian.
I'm hating you, bandwagon jumper.
Spill without a federal agency looking over his shoulder.
If that spilled milk line ends up in the paper tomorrow, I swear to you, That's it. I'm done with it.
Are you going to shoot yourself?
I might.
But I will not back down for making sure an oil company can contain the kind of oil spill we saw in the Gulf 2 years ago.
Ah, oh, Al Franken.
From protecting our kids from mercury poisoning. We're making sure that our food is safe and our water is clean. I will not go back to the days when health insurance companies had unchecked power to cancel your policy, deny your coverage, or charge women.
There you go. There it is, Mary.
All right, be quiet.
Sorry.
And I will not go back to the days when Wall Street was allowed to play by its own set of rules.
He left that bus running.
The new rules we passed.
Damn.
What should be any financial system's core purpose. Getting funding to entrepreneurs with the best ideas and getting loans to responsible families who want to buy a home or start a business or send their kids to college. So if you are a big bank or financial institution, you're no longer allowed to make risky bets with your customers' deposits. You're required to write out a living will that details exactly how you'll pay the bills if you fail, because the rest of us are not bailing you out ever again.
You co-signed TARP.
All this hogwash he's talking.
So,
if you're a mortgage lender, or a payday lender, or a credit card company, the days of signing people up for products they can't afford with confusing forms and deceptive practices, those days are over. Today, American consumers finally have a watchdog in Richard Cordray with one job: to look out for them.
If I want to get in debt, I want to get in debt. I don't need no government watchdog.
There you go. That's called freedom, damn it.
We'll also establish a financial crimes unit of highly trained investigators to crack down on large-scale fraud and protect people's investments. Some financial firms violate major anti-fraud laws because there's no real penalty for being a repeat offender. That's bad for consumers, and it's bad for the vast majority of bankers and financial service professionals who do the right thing. So pass legislation that makes the penalties for fraud count. And tonight I'm asking my attorney general to create a special unit of federal prosecutors and leading state attorney general to expand our investigations into the abuse of lending and packaging of risky mortgages that led to the housing crisis. This new unit will hold accountable those who broke the law, speed assistance to homeowners, and help turn the page on an era of recklessness that hurt.
They're going to be busy tonight, ain't they? They signing bills, having things drawn up. I mean, damn.
We'll help protect our people and our economy. But it should also guide us as we look to pay down our debt and invest in our future.
Ugh.
Right now, our most immediate priority is stopping a tax hike on 160 million working Americans while the recovery is still fragile. People cannot afford losing $40 out of each paycheck this year. There are plenty of ways to get this done.
No. Did he say people can't afford losing $40 out of this paycheck this year?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is he talking about $40?
Yes, he is. He's talking about $40. He's going to save you $40, folks. $40.
When it comes to the deficit.
It's not every paycheck. That amounts to a lot.
No, he's not talking about $40 every paycheck. He said $40 this year.
No, he said every paycheck.
Yeah, he said every paycheck.
Okay. I was like, what?
It was supposed to be a temporary tax break for the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Right now, because of loopholes and shelters in the tax code, A quarter of all millionaires pay lower tax rates than millions of middle-class households. Right now, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary.
Ah, there's the secretary.
Do we want to keep these tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, or do we want to keep our investments in everything else, like education and medical research, a strong military, and care for our veterans? Because if we're serious about paying down our debt, we can't do both. The American people know what the right choice is. So do I. As I told the speaker this summer, I'm prepared to make more reforms to rein in the long-term costs of Medicare and Medicaid and strengthen Social Security so long as those programs remain a guarantee of security for seniors. But in return, we need to change our tax code so that people like me and an awful lot of members of Congress pay our fair share of taxes.
Said the same thing in 2008, Big Daddy.
I get a roaring applause. People did not stand up on this one. They're barely getting up for that.
Tax reform should follow the Buffett rule. If you make more than $1 million a year, you should not pay less than 30% in taxes.
Wow.
Corbyn is right. Washington should stop subsidizing millionaires. In fact, if you're earning $1 million a year, you shouldn't get special tax subsidies or deductions. On the other hand, if you make under $250,000 a year, like 98% of American families, your taxes shouldn't go up. You're the one struggling with rising costs and stagnant wages. You're the ones who need relief. Now, you can call this class warfare all you want.
He went there.
But asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes? Most Americans would call that common sense. We don't begrudge financial. When Americans talk about me paying my fair share of taxes, it's not because they envy the rich. It's because they understand that when I get a tax break, I don't need, and the country can't afford.
2 minute warning, Chief.
I got you, boss.
I can't hear it. What are you doing?
You got a coach. The end of the show in 1:45.
What is the State of the Union over? Is it over at 10 or is it 2 hours?
I don't know.
Huh?
20, it's probably an hour.
About 90 minutes.
Our way of life is only endured. Yes.
Oh, Raleigh Factor's going to be good tonight.
We gotta go, guys. Unfortunately, we'll watch the rest of this and we'll bring you an update tomorrow on Reese on the Radio on Hump Day.
No matter what,
we appreciate you hanging out with us. And if you joined us even to listen to the presidential debate, which you probably watched on television, thank you for being a part of it. We'll give the breakdown tomorrow. We'll have the entire transcript and I will rip this apart as usual. It's Reese on the Radio. We will see ya tomorrow.
Can you blame them for feeling
good night,
what are you prepared to do? Everything within the law.
And then what are you prepared to do?
If you open the ball on these people, you must be prepared to go all the way. Because they won't give up the fight until one of you is dead.
I don't know how to get him.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. Do you want to do that? Are you ready to do that?